and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Wall Street Journal, from the Washington Post, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and all articles are read as printed. Podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article written on Religion News Service and published June 23rd. And this article is entitled, "Can a Tender-Hearted President Solve the Southern Baptists' Trust Problem?" The subheadline, "The Nation's Largest Protestant Denomination is Based on Voluntary Cooperation by More Than 40,000 Churches. That cooperation is threatened by growing distrust of national leaders." And this article is by Bob Smetana of Religion News Service. The Southern Baptist Convention has trouble with a capital T, and that stands for trust. The lack of trust was palpable during the SBC's recent annual meeting in Nashville, Tennessee, where local church messengers often overruled Baptist leaders from the meeting floor. As far as trust and leadership, that is one thing that came through loud and clear. James Pittman, pastor of New Hope Community Church in Palatine, Illinois, told Religion News Service in a phone interview after the annual meeting, "There's no trust." The SBC's leadership has gotten pushback in recent months over a statement against critical race theory made by the presidents of six SBC seminaries, costing the support of prominent black pastors, as well as over its slowness to get a handle on sexual abuse cataloged in a 2019 Houston Chronicle report. These controversies have been exacerbated by two high-profile departures, that of influential Bible study teacher Beth Moore, who disagreed with the SBC's leader's attachment to former President Donald Trump, and the denomination's chief ethicist, Russell Moore. The latter, who is not related to Beth Moore, was a champion of sexual abuse survivors, and in a letter leaked just weeks before the annual meeting, he criticized the leadership for silencing him. All of these internal pressures are playing out against the larger backdrop of decline. The SBC has lost more than 2 million members since 2016. The person charged with helping lead the convention forward is a soft-spoken Mobile, Alabama pastor, Ed Litton, best known for his work on racial reconciliation. Litton was elected SBC president in a hotly contested election, winning over Georgia pastor Mike Stone in a runoff. Stone is a founder of the Conservative Baptist Network, which contends the convention has become liberal and woke. His share of the presidential vote shows that many in the rank and file share the CBN's concern. Litton rejects those claims, but has said he wants to work with all Southern Baptists to iron out our differences. "I want to be clear that my goal is to build bridges and not walls," he said during his first news conference. Doing that will take a lot of work. Litton was candid about the challenges facing the SBC during an interview 2 days after his selection. Dressed in jeans and a sport coat, he described himself as a local church pastor who deals mostly with the real-life issues of people, rather than as a denominational influencer. "There are some people who fly at a 40,000-foot level. They see everything," he said. "I'm a crop duster." He said he has faith in the people of the SBC who he said love Jesus and want to love their neighbors. Just after he was elected, he said that outgoing President J.D. Greer, a North Carolina megachurch pastor, told him he would be blown away by how kind people would be to him, especially ordinary church members. Still, he said, he knows there will be troubles in trying to help Southern Baptists continue to work together. It's not an easy task. Despite being the largest Protestant denomination in the U.S., with about 14 million members, the SBC is a remarkably flat organization. Southern Baptists often say that the headquarters of the denomination is the local church. While they cooperate on missions, evangelism, disaster relief, education, and other ministries, all that cooperation is voluntary and often up for debate. Nathan Finn, a Baptist historian who serves as provost of North Greenville University in South Carolina, said the recent annual meeting was an example of the SBC's long history of insider versus outsider battles. "And for the most part, the insiders lost in Nashville," he said. Messengers from local churches overruled SBC leaders at several points, most notably over an investigation into how the denomination's executive committee has treated sexual abuse survivors and handled allegations of abuse. The executive committee wanted to oversee the investigations. Messengers were having none of that. "I think the Southern Baptists have said loud and clear that our leaders are denominational servants, and we intend to hold our denominational servants accountable," said Finn. Despite Litton's victory over Stone, Finn does not see the Conservative Baptist Network or other critics of current SBC leaders going away. There is this perennial tension over why are we cooperating and who do we trust to navigate the ship, he said. Pittman, the pastor at New Hope Church, left Nashville unsure of whether his congregation could remain in the SBC. I don't see a path forward with the convention, he said, adding that he and other New Hope leaders would meet soon to decide what to do next. New Hope, founded in the 1950s as the First Baptist Church of Palatine, has been part of the SBC for nearly seven decades. When Pittman arrived in 2014, the church had a handful of older members and was on the brink of closing. We got down to almost nobody, he said. We stayed around and said, let's see what God will do with this. New Hope has grown in recent years, transforming from a mostly white congregation to a diverse church. He said church members have been concerned about critical race theory and its effects on the SBC. Pittman, who is black, is mistrustful of CRT too, calling it a different gospel that assigned guilt to people based on the color of their skin. Pittman, a first-time attendee of the annual meeting, was disappointed that Southern Baptist messengers did not specifically reject CRT. He felt that Southern Baptist leaders didn't always follow their own rules. His church, he said, can't partner with an organization whose leaders do that. Evan Stewart, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts Boston, said the SBC reflects a bigger trend of public distrust of religious institutions. In recent decades, he said, confidence in organized religion has dropped, according to the General Social Survey. In the 1970s and 1980s, he said, about 30% of Americans had a great deal of confidence in organized religion. Today, that's dropped to about 20%, he said. It's hard to tell if that decline is from folks who say, I have no confidence in organized religion, or if folks are saying, I'm just a little more temperate in my confidence, he said. For his part, Litton said Southern Baptists have to decide whether they want to work together despite their differences. I think Southern Baptists have to ask themselves, or Great Commission Baptists have to ask themselves, do we really want to glorify God by cooperating, he said, using an alternate name for Southern Baptists. To cooperate, he said, they will have to exercise what he called their compassion muscles by loving their neighbors. He said Southern Baptists are known for their theology but have neglected that part of the faith. Litton told Religion News Service that he is ready for the challenge ahead, but he knows things could get ugly, and he worries that his church in North Mobile might not be ready for the criticism he will face. I feel the need to brace them for the social media, he said. I don't think they have a clue what's coming. Southern Baptists, he said, have to be tender with those who are suffering, and merciful for those who need the gospel. Being tender in Litton's eyes is not a sign of weakness. His approach to ministry, especially in recent years, has been shaped by personal tragedy. His first wife, Tammy, was killed in a car wreck after 25 years of marriage. Her death shook him. Litton said God was with him as he grieved, and the experience of grieving made him stronger and more empathetic to others. In a twist of fate, Litton played a pastor who comforts a grieving father whose daughter was killed in a car crash in the 2011 Christian movie, Courageous. That experience, he suggests, will give him what it takes to restore faith in the SBC. I've always been told as a pastor that I had empathy, he said, but the reality of pain means I have credibility. We'll turn next to an article published in the Wall Street Journal on June 22nd. This article is entitled, Francis Macron Pushes Controls on Religion to Pressure Mosques. And this article is by Noemi Bisserby and Stacey Miketry of the Wall Street Journal, Dateline, Paris. President Emmanuel Macron is redrawing the line that separates religion and state in a battle to force Islamic organizations into the mold of French secularism. In recent months, his administration has ousted the leadership of a mosque after temporarily closing it and poring over its finances. Another mosque gave up millions in subsidies after the government pressured local officials over the funding. A dozen other mosques have faced orders to close temporarily for safety or fire code violations. The government has taken these actions as a precursor to a much broader push to rein in the independence of mosques and other religious organizations across France. Mr. Macron has submitted a bill to Parliament called the Law Reinforcing Respect of the Principles of the Republic that would empower the government to permanently close houses of worship and dissolve religious organizations without court order if it finds that any of their members are provoking violence or inciting hatred. In addition, the bill would allow temporary closure of any religious group that spreads ideas that incite hatred or violence. Religious organizations would have to obtain government permits every 5 years to continue operating and have their accounts certified annually if they receive foreign funding. The bill will be debated next week in the National Assembly, where Mr. Macron's majority is expected to pass it by the end of the year. It applies to all houses of worship, including churches and synagogues, but the government's actions are aimed at mosques and Islamic organizations. Religious leaders say the government's push oversteps the religion-state divide created under a landmark 1905 law. That act forged laïcité, France's strict secularism, by barring religious groups from receiving state aid, with few exceptions, and excluding clergy from government posts. It also established freedom of conscience and freedom to practice religion within the bounds of public order. "We're giving too much power to the administration," said Shems Adin Hafiz, rector of the Grand Mosque of Paris. Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican's number two official, told French television that the legislation threatens the balance that was found over the course of the past century. Mr. Macron says he is defending France against what he calls Islamist separatism, which he describes as a political and religious project to create a parallel society where religious laws take precedence over civil ones. Its adherents, he says, use intimidation and violence to pressure teachers, health workers, and other civil servants to deviate from the French Republic's values, fueling years of attacks on French soil. "Terrorists who commit these acts are doing it in the name of this ideology," Mr. Macron told reporters in January. "We've seen there's continuity between this phenomenon and a fundamentalism that is less and less peaceful that legitimizes a break with the Republic." The government is pressuring mosques to sign a charter of principles attesting to their compliance with France's republican values. Some Muslim leaders have been reluctant to sign, saying the document defines the scope of religious practice too narrowly and have seen their organizations targeted by the government. French officials say they are holding mosques to a charter that was written by prominent Muslim leaders at the request of Mr. Macron. People involved in the drafting process, however, said that his interior minister, Gérald Darmanin, played a pivotal role in shaping the charter, closely supervising a small group of Muslim leaders he tapped to write it and barring any changes from other leaders who were then expected to sign it. A spokesman for Mr. Darmanin said he met with Muslim leaders to help facilitate discussions. Mohamed Moussaoui, chairman of the French Council of the Muslim Faith, or CFCM, says the fight against Islamist separatism is a priority for Muslim leaders, but he disputes that mosques are spreading it. "Radicalization takes place primarily in the digital space, not in places of worship," he said. France has gone further than any other Western country in confronting radical currents within Islam. In some German states, local authorities have signed agreements with Muslim groups in which they reject violence and discrimination. Austria has banned foreign funding for places of worship. In France, the question of Islam's influence on society has become the defining issue of next year's presidential election. At times, the Macron government has pointed to its push to regulate mosques as a sign it can outflank Marine Le Pen, the leader of the anti-immigrant National Rally Party and his main rival on the issue. Ms. Le Pen has tried to paint Mr. Macron as soft on Islamism, an imprecise and contentious term that some politicians in France use to generally describe a political or social movement that seeks to organize society in accordance with laws prescribed by Islam. During a recent debate with Mr. Darmanin, the interior minister, Ms. Le Pen criticized Mr. Macron's bill as an attack on religious freedom that blurs the lines between Islam and Islamism. "Islamism is an ideology, a totalitarian ideology, and we can certainly separate it from the religion," she said. "You need to take your vitamins. You're not tough enough," Mr. Darmanin said, leaving Ms. Le Pen with a stunned expression. "Madame Le Pen won't name the enemy. You are softer than we can be." Mr. Macron's party faces runoffs in regional elections on Sunday after falling far behind conservative candidates and the national rally in the first round of voting, which saw a high level of abstentions. Mohamed Hanich, who attends a mosque in the working-class Paris suburb of Pantin, was at home last October when a mosque volunteer sent him a video over WhatsApp. It showed a man railing against his daughter's middle school teacher for showing lewd cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in class. Islamic teachings forbid depictions of the Prophet. The man in the video said the teacher had told Muslim students to leave the classroom before the cartoons were displayed, a claim French prosecutors would later determine was false. The volunteer wanted permission to share the video on the mosque's Facebook page. The notion that Muslim students were being singled out struck a chord with Mr. Hanish. As chairman of the mosque, he gave the go-ahead. After the video was shared, a comment from someone police haven't publicly identified appeared on the mosque's page identifying the teacher and giving the address of his school. A week later, the teacher, Samuel Paty, was beheaded on his way home. Police suspected that the mosque's Facebook page led the attacker to Mr. Paty. Police shot and killed the assailant, an 18-year-old Russian of Chechen origin, minutes after the attack. The government temporarily shut the Pantan Mosque, invoking a law passed in the wake of 2015 terror attacks that included the massacre at Charlie Hebdo, the French satirical magazine, and coordinated attacks by Islamic State militants that killed 130 people across the Paris region. The law empowers the government to close a mosque for 6 months to counter acts of terrorism. The news came as a bombshell, said Fatima Liazami, a 68-year-old local resident who often prays at the Pantan Mosque. For Mr. Macron, the beheading of a teacher was an assault on everything the French Republic stands for. During a tribute at the foot of the illuminated 17th-century facade of the Sorbonne University, he cast the teacher as a symbol of France's Enlightenment values and the fight against Islamists. "We will not give up caricatures, drawings, even if others back down," he said. In November, Mr. Macron met inside the Élysée Palace with leaders of the CFCM, representing France's highly divided Muslim population. Some of those gathered in the Gilded Chamber oversaw mosques funded by Algeria and Morocco, former colonies that maintained close ties with Paris. Others represented Muslims who had emigrated more recently from Turkey, where tensions with France were on the rise. Mr. Macron said he wanted the leaders to write a charter to reassure the country that they, as representatives of French Muslims, supported France's secular and republican values. He said he was worried that mistrust of Muslims was growing across France. He sought to reassure the group the government wasn't overstepping its bounds. "Listen, we are not here to tell you who is or who isn't a practicing Muslim," he said. Mr. Macron tapped Mr. Darmanin to coordinate negotiations among Muslim leaders to draft the charter. Mr. Moussaoui, the Muslim Council's chairman, said Mr. Darmanin responded to the group's initial draft with a request to shorten much of it, but on one part wanted more detail, the rejection of the use of Islam for political aims. Debate ensued within the Muslim Council over what constituted political activity by mosques. The Algeria-funded Grand Mosque of Paris supported a broad rebuke of any interference in political matters. But Milli Görüş, a group representing Turkey's Muslim diaspora, worried that the charter would act as a muzzle for Muslims wanting to participate in political debates in France and their country of origin. Several leaders noted that some of the issues that animate French politics, such as the ban on civil servants wearing Muslim headscarves at work, collided with Islamic teachings. Mr. Darmanin summoned Mr. Moussaoui and his two CFCM deputies, Mr. Hafiz and Ibrahim Alsi, leader of the Coordinating Committee for Turkish Muslims in France. "The group spent hours in the Interior Minister's office working on a new draft," Mr. Hafiz said, with the minister dipping out for an official lunch. When he returned, the group read through the text and finalized it. Mr. Hafiz recalled the minister's parting words to the three, who are now under instruction to solicit signatures from the other Muslim leaders. "We're not changing a comma of this text." The spokesman for Mr. Darmanin declined to comment when asked about that line. The new version, titled the Charter of Principles for Islam of France, required signatories to reject all forms of political Islam. It defined that as movements such as Salafism, a school of Sunni Islam that teaches strict interpretation of Sharia law, as well as ideologies linked to national and transnational organizations such as the Muslim Brotherhood. The text described as defamatory any attempt by Muslims to accuse the state of racism or claim victimhood. It rejected any use of mosques for the dissemination of nationalist speeches defending foreign regimes and supporting foreign policies hostile to France, our country, and our French compatriots. Any group that violated the charter, it said, would face ejection from all representative bodies of Islam of France. The next day, Mr. Moussaoui showed the new draft to other CFCM leaders. After hours of debate, he said, he delivered an ultimatum: take it or leave it. "There is total incomprehension and stupefaction," said Fatih Sarakir, president of the French chapter of Milli Görüş. He objected to several points, from the definition of political Islam to the rejection of discrimination based on sexual orientation. Milli Görüş and two other groups would later issue a point-by-point rebuttal of the charter, including saying that Islamic teachers consider homosexuality a sin. When Mr. Moussaoui called Mr. Macron's office that evening, a presidential aide told him Mr. Macron wanted to organize a signing ceremony the next day with all of the leaders present. Mr. Moussaoui said some weren't ready to sign. On January 18th, the ceremony went ahead without Mr. Sarikir and leaders of two other groups. Leaders who refused to sign, a close advisor to Mr. Macron said in an interview at the time, exposed their groups to doubts about their attachment to the Republic. So we will be very, very attentive to their operations in terms of control, surveillance, sermon analysis, and financing, the aide said. In March, the City Council of Strasbourg voted to earmark 2.5 million euros, or $3 million, to help Milly Gorouche finish building a monumental mosque in eastern France near the German border. The group had spent years raising funds for the 32 million euro project. Massive concrete walls were already erected. The project was eligible for subsidies because Strasbourg is in Alsace-Moselle, a borderland that was under Prussian rule in 1905 when France adopted its law on laïcité. A concordat Napoleon Bonaparte and the Vatican reached in 1801 remains in force there, permitting Strasbourg to subsidize religious groups. After the city council vote, Mr. Darmanin posted a Twitter message accusing Strasbourg Mayor Jean Barsegian of financing a mosque backed by a group that refuses to sign the Charter of Principles of Islam of France and that defended political Islam. He later told French radio, "The goal is to make it so the enemies of the Republic, those opposed to the values of the Republic, can't continue living in France." The comments set off a firestorm. Ms. Barsegian requested a security detail after receiving threats. One poll showed that 78% of respondents across France supported abrogation of the 1801 Concordat in Alsace-Moselle. Mr. Macron weighed in from a summit in Brussels. "When you have associations that admit they are not capable of adhering to the values of the Republic, that's a problem," he said, adding that some local authorities were perhaps too accommodating. Ms. Barsegian said the French government hadn't given her any warning before the city council vote that Milly Gorouche presented a threat to Republican values. She said her final approval for the subsidy would depend on Milly Gorouche providing a transparent report on how it was funding the rest of the project. She also demanded it endorse the Charter of Principles. Milly Gorouche withdrew its application for the study. For the subsidy. "We had become a source of tension, something we never wanted," Mr. Sarikir said. 300 miles away in Paris, the government's order to close the Mosque of Pantin, housed in a former gymnasium owned by the town, was running up against its six-month limit. No one at the mosque had been charged in connection with the teacher's beheading, but French authorities used the closure to pressure the mosque into making deep changes. They insisted the mosque oust one imam, saying his sermons were inspired by visits to a Salafist website and his children attended a clandestine Islamic school. The imam declined to comment. Authorities ordered the mosque to appoint women to the board of its governing association. Mr. Haniche, its president, complied, replacing the imam with someone who practices a more moderate form of Islam. He agreed to broader oversight of the mosque's Facebook page. But there was one demand Mr. Haniche opposed, his own resignation. When he resisted, the government sent him a letter withdrawing his association's license to operate. The city of Pantin also stepped in, threatening to cancel a lease on land where Mr. Haniche's association planned to build a new mosque, for which Mr. Haniche had already collected €700,000 from residents. Mr. Haniche resigned. The mosque was allowed to reopen in April after its new leaders included the Charter of Principles in the mosque's statutes, according to the government and Mr. Haniche, who remains a member of the mosque's governing association. "This is blackmail," Mr. Haniche said. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with an article published on the website SCOTUS Blog, which is a website covering the U.S. Supreme Court. And the title of this article is "Court Requires Religious Exemption But Leaves Many Questions Unanswered." This was published on July 22nd, and it's written by Holly Holloman. And she is the General Counsel and Associate Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. And we'll need to edit this a bit for time, given how much time we have left. In Fulton v. City of Philadelphia, the court came to a surprisingly unanimous result. Philadelphia violated Catholic Social Services' free exercise rights by denying it a contract based on the agency's refusal to comply with the city's non-discrimination policy. How did the court get there? Not in the way that CSS and many of its allies hoped, nor in a way that Philadelphia and many of its allies feared. The 15-page opinion of Chief Justice John Roberts focused on a contract provision allowing the commissioner of the city's Department of Human Services to grant exemptions in her sole discretion. The provision was presumably designed to help ensure that the placement of a child with a particular foster parent is in the best interest of the child. The city had never exempted a contractor from its non-discrimination requirement for certifying potential foster parents. The court, however, found that because of the government's discretion, the city's non-discrimination policy was not generally applicable, and thus not subject to the Employment Division versus Smith rule that would deny exemptions from neutral laws of general applicability. Instead, the court held that this contract language triggered strict scrutiny of the city's denial of a religious exemption to CSS. As Roberts explained, a government policy can survive strict scrutiny only if it advances interests of the highest order and is narrowly tailored to achieve those interests. Put another way, so long as the government can achieve its interests in a manner that does not burden religion, it must do so. Without overruling Smith, which CSS and many of its allies had urged it to do, the court held that Philadelphia must exempt CSS from working with same-sex couples in the government function of certifying potential foster parents. Justices Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch concurred only in the result, not the reasoning, and argued in separate opinions that Smith should be revisited. For three decades, Smith has been criticized for failing to provide sufficient religious liberty protection, including from Christian organizations that supported the city in Fulton. In a case addressing the enforcement of drug laws against Native Americans who ingested peyote as a religious sacrament, Smith held that the Free Exercise Clause does not necessarily protect against government-imposed burdens on religion. The decision left room for courts to apply a higher level of scrutiny in rare circumstances. In addition, the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act and similar state laws and constitutional rulings countered Smith by requiring that the government have a compelling reason before imposing a substantial burden on the exercise of religion. Smith, however, remains the applicable law in many cases. Briefs criticizing Smith were filed on both sides of Fulton. But as Justice Amy Coney Barrett emphasized in her concurrence, revisiting Smith was unnecessary for the court's decision and would raise difficult questions about what would replace it. The Fulton decision seems strategically crafted to avoid revisiting Smith, at least for now. The court seemed to rely on a single fact, the prospect of exceptions, both to trigger strict scrutiny and to conclude that the city cannot meet that standard. The failure to seriously engage the city's arguments allowed the court to avoid key questions that makes these cases difficult. Fulton marks the second time the court has upheld on narrow grounds a free exercise claim in a clash between a religious objection to same-sex marriage and a government rule prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people. The 2018 Masterpiece Cake Shop decision in favor of a baker who refused on religious grounds to make a custom wedding cake for a same-sex couple was based on an administrative record that the court said showed hostility toward religion. The court did not address whether and under what circumstances the Constitution requires an exemption to Colorado's non-discrimination law more broadly. These modest decisions have the virtue of judicial restraint. They avoid an all-or-nothing outcome, either for those who seek the broadest religious exemption rights or those who argue against any religious exemptions. In that respect, the rulings are consistent with a religious liberty tradition that recognizes and balances multiple interests. But Fulton and Masterpiece have done little to help lower courts, and the same conflicts will keep coming. We've run out of time for this week on Religion in the News. We thank you for tuning in and hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts are available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org. And we'll talk to you next time. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.